plastic. It's something we all depend on, and yet we also know that it's absolutely terrible for our environment. Some of us do our best to limit our plastic waste. Maybe we carry a reusable water bottle or bring our own bags to the grocery store, but deep down, we know that it's not enough. But inside that idea is a notion that we all take for granted. The plastic waste in our cities and our oceans is our fault, and it's our responsibility to confront. But there are some who claim that this is actually the wrong framework. According to ecologist Matt Wilkins, we have been duped into thinking that we, as individuals, caused the plastic problem, when really, it's the plastic producers and lax regulation that are to blame. Matt has a new article in Scientific American called "More Recycling Won't Save Plastic Pollution." He joins us today along with Rebecca Altman, an environmental sociologist and plastic historian who's written about plastic for The Atlantic, and she has a forthcoming book about the subject. Matt, Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
So Matt, I'll start with you. Towards the beginning of your article, you say that recycling plastic is to saving the earth what hammering a nail is to halting a falling skyscraper. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I struggled for the correct analogy, and some people have kind of criticized that. But basically what I was looking for is an image that sort of represents the scale of the problem relative to our actions. And recycling is far from our best tool for dealing with plastic pollution. It's necessarily inefficient. And as you alluded to earlier, I think part of the reason that we focus on recycling as the primary solution and that it should be individuals cleaning up their litter and taking care of their own trash, right, or their own recycling, I think, you know, there's evidence, and, you know, I'm not the first person to report about this, that Keep America Beautiful and other industrial lobbying groups have successfully marketed to shift that paradigm so that, you know, we feel guilty about our, you know, problem here, while the producers that are producing literally billions of plastic bottles a year they're basically not held responsible at all for that.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about Keep America Beautiful. That's a very specific campaign. Tell us about who's involved and what they've accomplished.
Right. So I first read about this from some reporting by Bradford Plumer and Mother Jones. And he lays out and I've read this in several other places. Heather Rogers has lays this out in a book as well. That basically they were formed in 1953 at the same time that Vermont passed a piece of legislation called the Beverage Container Law that basically outlawed the sale of beverages in non-refillable containers. And so some industrial partners, including Coca-Cola, and now extends to, I believe, Pepsi and a large number of industrial representatives.
Philip Morris was originally involved.
Philip Morris as well, yeah. So basically they were instrumental in marketing against this legislation, and due to industrial pressure from the beverage company, the beverage industry, this piece of legislation was basically not renewed after 4 years.
So you describe Keep America Beautiful as the first corporate greenwashing front. Explain what you mean by that term. I think it's a helpful term.
Yeah, so by greenwashing front, I mean that it's an organization that seems benevolent, and they seem to have a good goal, which is increasing individual responsibility for, you know, your own for living sustainably, but their main focus is recycling, and so that's where it gets a little murky, because this is a group, Keep America Beautiful, which is representing, you know, Coca-Cola, and basically, you know, these are companies that make their money by selling you plastic waste with their product. So previous to that, you know, we had reusable containers, but now we have this idea that, you know, that the vessel is worthless, and that it has no value, and we throw it away. Or we recycle it. And so they're encouraging individuals to recycle, but what it hides is the fact that, you know, maybe that single-use vessel shouldn't have been produced in the first place.
It puts the sort of onus on the individual as opposed to giving some responsibility to plastic producers, right?
Exactly.
So, Rebecca, you've written about the history of plastics, and in your writing you talk about how your father worked for one of the first plastic producers. Can you give us a little background on how the plastic industry evolved during its early days?
Sure. So my dad made plastics in the 1960s, so that was the era of the graduate. Plastics was making a big transition.
Exactly,
in the
how 1960s. Far we've come.
Yeah. So what was happening in the 1960s is production was really taking off. This is just before the EPA came online, before the introduction of the plastic-handled bag, before the introduction of the now ubiquitous water bottle or soda bottle. So he was kind of just part of that true plastics era. But he was making plastics at a time when plastics were becoming a bulk commodity and were going from being a durable good into being a disposable good. He was making polystyrene, which is one of the big bulk commodity plastics, but he was also making Bakelite, which was one of the original synthetic plastics, and that was a durable good. Phones were made from Bakelite. Radios were made from Bakelite, and they were built to last.
I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Matt Wilkins, ecologist, and Rebecca Altman, an environmental sociologist, about plastic use in the plastic industry. Matt, what are some of the specific bills or policies that Keep America Beautiful fought against that you think would have helped decrease use of plastics?
Starting, you know, basically with the fledgling bill that, you know, Vermont passed, 1953. I don't claim to be a historian on all of this stuff, and in fact, it's kind of hard to know because a lot of, you know, this pressure may have happened, you know, not in the public view.
But perhaps this legislation was being drafted and conceived, yes?
Right, and I know that, you know, that between 1989 and 1994. The beverage industry writ large, of which Keep America Beautiful, you know, was part of, they spent $14 million to defeat the national bottle bill. And so if that had passed, I mean, we would be far and beyond what even the EU is doing now in order to ameliorate the plastic problem.
So let's fast forward to the present, where the danger posed by plastics to the environment is pretty widely understood, and it's usually understood in the context of our oceans. That seems to be the space where these conversations, you know, usually take place. We know about how animals can get stuck in bags and six-pack holders, but the more recent data suggests that animals and other organisms are actually consuming microplastics. And so now we're in a situation where plastic enters the food chain, and it literally might be inside our bodies right now as we speak. Do I have that right, Rebecca?
Yes, from what I've learned from my colleagues who are doing this work, this is pretty much the cutting edge of the research questions they're asking now. So we're getting beyond questions of entanglements and looking at how plastics over time break down into smaller and smaller pieces, and the relationship or the way they function almost as magnets, adsorbing other ambient pollution in the marine environment and then carrying it up and through the food web. How it moves through the food web under different conditions, what species are affected, how it leaps levels. I mean, these are all questions under current investigation right now, and it is a hot topic and an important one.
And yet, despite all the science, single-use plastics are still extremely common. Here in New York, for example, you can't even buy a bag of chips at a deli without them giving you a plastic bag to put them in. So why is there such a disconnect between what we know and how we act, Rebecca?
That is the key right there. That is a question I'm deeply curious about. And one of the ways that I've been thinking a lot about it is how is it that we have kind of lost sight of understanding where plastics come from, both their history and their root basis in the fossil fuel economy. I think when I explain to people that plastics come from the byproducts of oil or gas production, that is usually a light bulb moment. But it engenders all kinds of amazing conversations about how plastics come into our lives and how they've come to be in our lives in ways that are even beyond our understanding or even consent. They're just become highly routinized and familiar, and no longer questioned as to how are we relating to this material, and why is it presumed that it is given to us so automatically at a point of sale or at a restaurant.
Well, there's this issue, as you just pointed out there at the end of your comment, this issue of societal norms, right?
Yeah.
I mean, even consider our federal government. Anytime we see a Senate hearing or a House hearing and the person called to give testimony, plastic bottles are in front of them as opposed to a water glass, yes?
Yes. And these are the conversations to be having now, is how did we get to a place where these were that became the presumed norms, and what are the drivers of plastics use? And be able to think with each other in conversations with the groups, the networks, the communities in which we're involved, and having these larger conversations about where are the critical steps to intervene. What would it mean if our elected officials went back to using the old-fashioned glass and pitcher?
Right. Or hustling into the offices for the morning. We always see the snapshots of them with their morning coffee in hand with a plastic lid. Imagine a coffee cup or a travel mug in their hand. Matt, this is sometimes called the petrochemical industrial complex, right?
Right. Exactly.
So let's keep on plastic bags for a second. We know that the California banned them almost 2 years ago, and they seem to be doing just fine without them. But in New York, the fight against plastic bags has been extremely fraught. The city tried to charge a 5-cent fee for single bag use. Then the state blocked that law and introduced a preemption bill. Then this past spring, Governor Cuomo introduced his own bill to ban them statewide, but it's unclear if that will pass. So there's been a lot of political back and forth here in New York, and I'm sure in many other places, but in a more general sense, why is it so difficult to pass laws limiting plastic bags? Matt, do you have a thought on that?
That's a really good question. It seems like it should be, very straightforward. I would say the main reason is that the industry is pushing back on that, and there's a lot of money to be made in plastics. That's why it was referenced in The Graduate, right, as an area of economic growth, and that is still continuing to this day. And in fact, the situation in California is pretty interesting because of their proposition, their legislative situation, where they basically, the new laws can be held to a referendum. And in that case, the plastic bag industry seems to have fought pretty hard against that state law banning the free distribution of plastic bags. And they spent millions of dollars basically to fight that that ballot measure while also adding a measure that was confusing. It was actually designed to confuse voters and to be punitive to grocery stores and other organizations that were supporting the plastic bag ban. And despite that, industry lost in both cases by a kind of a narrow margin, but they seem to be sort of using some marketing subterfuge by using names like the Progressive Plastic Bag Coalition,
right,
which is what we also call AstroTurf.
Right.
So instead of a grassroots, it is an AstroTurf. It is another case of corporate greenwashing or subterfuge, where they basically try to trick us into following legislative measures that will basically benefit them economically.
Well, and I mentioned preemption laws. You've done some reporting on that, Matt. Tell us what those are.
So preemption laws would mean a law that basically prevents a local city or municipality from passing a local ban or a tax on plastic bags. So if you're a city that, you see a problem with, plastic bags and Coke bottles, clogging your waterways and your gutters, and you want to do something about it, in 10 states currently, you can't do that. And this is sort of, under the guise of, basically maintaining uniformity and trying to, keep it easy for businesses to, that operate in multiple cities. To have a consistent legal framework, but you have to suspect that there's something else going on. And in fact, I've read some reporting that the American Legislative Exchange Council, also known as ALEC, produced some sort of boilerplate legislation that basically created these preemption bans and then made it easy for other states to kind of, you know, fill in their state in the blank and, you know, pass these bans. And that's kind of why they spread so quickly.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I'm speaking with ecologist Matt Wilkins and environmental sociologist Rebecca Altman about why more recycling won't solve the plastic pollution issue. Now, I want to shift the conversation over to recycling. And even though we were talking earlier about how this can't be our only solution, it's still the most visible and obvious system we have in place when it comes to dealing with plastic. But there can be a lot of confusion, like what do we do, what do those different numbers mean on regarding which type of plastics are actually reusable, recyclable? So first off, what do these different numbers mean on the bottom of plastic containers? Rebecca, I'll let you answer that.
Sure. Yes, this is. These are some trying questions. There are. If you flip over your water bottle, or you look at the lid of a coffee cup, you will see a small stamp imprinted on it. There's typically a letter and the number. And historically there was a little recycling chasing arrow symbol, but that recently was switched on purpose to be a triangle because of the confusion. Originally, that was interpreted of saying, you know, this particular item is recyclable, and people assumed it meant that there was an entire system and infrastructure and technology in place for that article to then have some kind of reuse after it went into the blue bin. What it in fact does is just identifies the type of plastic or resin that that item is made from, that then a person can cross-reference against their city or municipality's recycling program to find out, is this particular type of plastic recyclable in my area? So it is part of the, you know, how do we recycle? We have to know what kinds of resins we're using, and also whether we have a system that can handle them. But for a long time, people understood that symbol to mean this article would be recycled, and that's not the case. And so a few years ago, the symbol was shifted very quietly. In fact, I didn't even realize it until recently, was shifted from that iconic recycling chasing arrow symbol to a simple equilateral triangle. And so what you have on there are numbers 1 through 7. Each one stands for a common type of plastic. The seventh is an other category, and that sure contains a lot of other kinds of plastics that aren't being called out.
Right. And so the idea is that sort of the lower numbers, 1 and 2 and 3, are the more easily recycled materials. That's the idea anyway, correct?
Yeah, three is polyvinyl chloride. We don't have a huge system in place for handling that as I understand it. One is, and two tend to be more readily recyclable given infrastructure, technology, markets, et cetera. Although all of that can be in flux and shifting at the regional all the way up to the international level.
Another issue here is a downcycling, or the idea that bottles don't necessarily become new bottles but get turned into something else, and that new product might not be recyclable a second time. How does downcycling fit into this conversation, Matt?
So I think many people, when they throw a water bottle in the blue bin, they think, okay, well, you know, that's just going to become a new bottle, so I've, you know, done my part. But what I think most people don't realize is that that's often not the case. And there's a number of reasons for that. One of the main reasons is purity. And since most of the U.S. uses a single-stream recycling process in which we throw all of our paper and aluminum and everything in the same bin, you know, then it provides an increased challenge for the recycling processing. So these things have to be sorted, you know, through complex machinery at a, you know, an off-site facility, you know, incorporating some, you know, increasingly complicated technology, but also manual sorting. So if people, you know, throw something in there like, you know, I don't know, tissues, because you're like, oh, well, you know, I just blew my nose, but, you know, this is paper, so right, it should be recyclable, right? Well, no. In fact, that's that should be discouraged. And, you know, I call this recycler's guilt. This is, you know, you basically don't want to throw anything away, right? But you could actually be contaminating the stream. And so in terms of plastic, because of all the different types of plastic that are thrown together, these can be very difficult to sort. You can imagine it's hard to get a machine that reads the little triangle on there and separates them, right?
Right.
They can separate them out through, you know, distillation or you know, separation downstream, but, you know, all of this leads to contamination. And so that means that it's really hard to get a pure enough collection of the clear number one plastic bottles to make more clear number one bottles.
The manual separating that's required is, I think, an important point, and your example of the tissue is a good one. I know a lot of people have questions about sort of cleanliness of plastic. If the plastic is housed of a food product of some kind, is that a major factor in terms of its recyclability? Does it need to be cleaned out thoroughly?
I think so. I feel like some of that needs to be addressed at a local level. It may depend on exactly how they're... You know, so I feel like some facilities may be better equipped to deal with kind of, you know, levels of contamination like that. But in general, you want it to be as clean as possible.
And Rebecca...
And for example, sorry,
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's actually not that important because it's about cardboard.
Well, Rebecca, where does it all go? I mean, is it true that a lot of our recycling actually gets sold to China?
My understanding is that historically, yes, but there are changes that are afoot, and China has passed some new regulations in terms of what kinds of materials they're willing to let into the country for processing there, and it has really changed the conversation in parts of Europe and in the United States, and has really forced a hard look at the existing technology and infrastructure, for example, that is available here in the United States. It's really pushing the conversation about how to redesign products for the end in mind, and also to really rethink about what needs to be in place here to handle the waste and recycling that are coming through our material feeds.
Yeah, it's very helpful, I think, to understand that it's not a permanent system that always works. It's a sort of a system that's in flux all the time.
Yeah.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I'm speaking with ecologist Matt Wilkins and environmental sociologist Rebecca Altman about why more recycling won't solve plastic pollution. So we spent a lot of time talking about the problem, of course, but let's focus a bit on solutions. And something that I think each of your work has in common is this idea that we need to look beyond what we do as individuals and think a little bit further up the food chain and focus on collective actions or policy decisions. Rebecca, you highlighted a novel approach in a town in the UK. What was going on there, and what can we learn from this town? Penzance.
I was struck by some of the Guardian's reporting on what's going on in the Cornwall region, where communities are thinking about plastics in a very collective way. And what really struck me was that individuals decided to kind of reach beyond themselves and say, what's my sphere of influence? What are the places, the institutions that I can touch? So, for example, cafe owners were banding together and having conversations about plastics, and were together talking to their suppliers and putting pressure on their suppliers, or renegotiating contracts, or thinking together, what if we formed this cup buying block so that we can get a better price on alternatives? And it just really signaled to me, this is where plastics conversations need to go, beyond just figuring out, I can change my water bottle, I can carry a reusable mug, to how can I affect change in the places I touch, if I'm on a team, if I'm at an office place, a house of worship, if I'm part of a board, if I'm, you know, or even reaching beyond, if I can affect not just a restaurant, can I go all the way to the chain level? Can I begin having conversations with stakeholders and to try to maximize or kind of get a domino effect going in the places that I touch? And that article really brought that issue to light. And kudos to Cornwall for beginning those conversations.
Yeah, and the office is a good example, right? I mean, maybe even just stop handing out water bottles at corporate meetings.
Right, right. I mean, it's almost like those purchasing decisions aren't even actually getting made anymore. Somewhere along the way, somebody decided please ship, a case of 24 bottles every month, right? And so nobody's actually making that decision anymore. A case just shows up, and then it's just distributed. So this automaticity or routinization of plastics in our world, those conversations can start happening. And then the next conversation is, what's driving its use? Who are the stakeholders? Who can we have a conversation with about the role that plastics are playing, and what alternatives are there?
Rebecca, another solution you talk about in your work is extended producer responsibility. I mean, does this tie into all of this that you're saying here? Is that how we're just calling that, or is that a specific program?
I mean, this is a bigger idea, and Matt already touched upon it a little bit. But it's this idea of those who are producing plastics or using plastics to market and transport their products to market should be involved in the conversation of what happens to that product after its end life. So bottle makers would be responsible for the bottles that they're ultimately making. And so extended producer responsibility, it's a type of program. It's an alternative framework for recycling in which manufacturers have a larger role at the table, and where recycling isn't just the burden of, for example, taxpayers and municipalities to handle, that producers are ultimately held responsible for the goods they make and their end-of-life issues they pose.
So on a more big picture level, a lot of the problems with plastic waste can be traced back to our attitudes towards disposability. Rebecca, you can talk. I want you to talk for a minute, if you would, about the behavior of throwing things out. Just the idea of things being sort of used for short term, and that being sort of the norm that we live in.
This is a very interesting area of work that social scientists and historians have really created an incredible picture around. It is a social innovation, disposability. The idea of discarding is a social innovation. So when you look at a plastic bag, you think, wow, polyethylene was a real technological innovation. The design of that handled carrier bag, also a huge innovation. But the real innovation that matters in that bag is the one in which it became acceptable and routinized that it could be used for as short as 30 seconds and then discarded. And this idea actually emerges out of the Great Depression, and you think, well, how could that be? The Great Depression was an era in which culturally everybody was strapping down and trying to save and conserve and reuse as much as possible. But this idea comes out of industrial design, that if we could build products that could have a much shorter lifespan, be used and then rebought, we could drive the engine of manufacturing and get the economy going again. That was the idea, planned obsolescence. And so it emerges out of the Great Depression. It kind of has a hard time catching on during World War II because of shortages again, but it really takes off and becomes kind of part of the marketing scheme for how so many products were sold, this idea that you could use it once and repurchase it. And it was what really allowed plastics to become a major industry, because they knew they could count on repeat purchases.
Right. Well, and going back to where we started, Matt, with the idea of sort of being overwhelmed by the problem as individuals, you know, in the end, we're all just humans trying to live our lives, and plastic remains useful for lots of different things. The point being that going 100% waste-free is pretty impossible, at least at this point, for most of us. So how do we strike a balance in our day-to-day lives as individuals, why we sort of lobby for and hope for these systemic changes?
Right. Yeah. So this is something that I've struggled, as my understanding of the scale of this problem has increased over the years. You know, I've tried to cut, plastic from my life in various ways. So I can just tell you personally the ways that I've been able to and the places that I've struggled to. I am an avid recycler. I study up on my local facilities and what they take and what they don't take. For example, in Nashville, they take numbers 1 through 7 plastic, although, as Rebecca alluded to, number 7 is a catch-all, and so some number 7s they actually can't recycle. So, like, compostable plastic spoons, for example, or other things that might be labeled number 7, like cups. If it says number 7 PLA, that is actually a compostable and it's not recyclable in almost every place in the world. So that can also complicate the recycling system. But I do recycle, but I think that's very important. But the most important tool is to reduce. So to refuse straws and plastic cutlery. I carry reusable plastic bags with me to every place. Clothes shopping or grocery store or Home Depot, where people look at me strange. It's interesting how certain places, like Whole Foods, probably the majority of shoppers have reusable bags, but other places like Walmart here in Tennessee, you get a lot of weird looks. They're like, "Whoa, what do I do?" They start automatically putting.
You have to almost fight off the plastic bag in some cases,
you
right?
You do, yeah. It becomes a really active thing, and it comes with this routine wastefulness that we've kind of, that's just kind of become part of our culture.
Yeah. A lot of choices have been put out there for us in terms of alternative bagging options, reusable straws, and so forth. There are a lot of products out there that can help us try to strike this balance. Rebecca, anything you would add to that in terms of how you even personally go about striking this balance in your day-to-day life?
I would just try to keep pushing the conversation that we can be more than just anti-litter bugs, more than just great recyclers, and more than better consumers. We can be citizens, and we can have a say in the kinds of policies that are driving plastics production into places where it becomes either toxic for communities, not just the marine communities, but actual communities where toxics are produced. Think about how can we collectively enter into different relationships with this material.
Right. Yeah, and your point about where the plastics are produced is a good one, too. We haven't been able to bring that into the conversation, but communities in Middle America far away from oceans and big cities have this problem in their back door, right?
Yeah, yes, and have been struggling with it for decades, dealing with byproducts, waste, emissions, releases. It's the less visible part of the plastics problem as it's currently being covered, but it is no less critical and important to really think hard about as a society.
Well, I'm so grateful to both of you for your reporting, just because it changes the conversation and gets us focused on the bigger picture and gets us moving past our personal guilt and looking toward some systemic solutions we can find together. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I've been speaking with ecologist Matt Wilkins and environmental sociologist Rebecca Altman about why more recycling won't solve plastic pollution.